Welcome to session 404, Replevin. What's mine is mine, unless it's yours. And you'll find out what that means. I'm David Howery, the archivist of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. This session grows out of two sessions at last year's SAA meeting. And I'm going to provide a little background on the topic and follow up on some of the discussions that began last summer. And then we'll turn to our panelists. Their presentations are intended to stimulate discussion and questions, and we're not presenting formal papers this morning. Controversies regarding the sale of alienated public records have grabbed more attention in recent years, especially as certain high-profile cases receive national publicity, and I believe the internet economy has raised the ease and visibility of the sale of records. Following up on the discussions of Replevin last year, Conley Edwards, he's back there, former state archivist of Virginia, and I, representing the Council of State Archivists, met with representatives of the Manuscript Society to discuss possible common ground between government archivists and the dealers and sellers and buyers of government documents. And so we've actually done so. Our two boards reached a basic agreement this winter, and we're now working on implementation procedures and are very close to agreement on those. I should point out that almost unanimous agreement exists that dealers and archivists will cooperate in the recovery of documents stolen from government archives. And this really includes non-government materials as well as government records, that dealers are not selling stolen materials. Of course, the vast majority of government documents that come on the market never reached the archives, and there's no evidence that they were actually stolen from the government. Both groups in this process have become more cognizant of the need to conduct due diligence, which means basically investigating the provenance of government records that are being offered for sale. For example, ask if the seller is the employee of the government archives, of the government office that produced the record, when you are approached by someone wanting to sell a document. And of course, as some of us in the government archives business have learned, employees do steal things. So we very much would appreciate it if dealers would ask the person who's offering documents to them where they work and how they got the document. You know, such due diligence can establish if those documents were indeed stolen or if other factors related to their alienation raise other types of concerns. And this, we believe this is a very important first step for archivists and dealers in resolving some of our differences. My assessment is that there are two basic areas of disagreement between archivists and sellers and collectors. And the first of these will likely never be resolved. Most government archivists believe that government records appraised as archival rightly can only belong to the archives, and the archives has the obligation to repatriate all such documents that have wandered out of our hands. And of course, state laws vary as to the degree they support this position, and some make it much easier than others to recover such documents. Most dealers and collectors, on the other hand, believe that such government documents may be bought and sold just as private papers would be when they have not been actually stolen. The records may have been in private hands for many years. They may have been given away, thrown away by government officials. They may have been sold many times before for many, many years, and so forth. In their view, the dealer's view, certain circumstances such as these void the government's claim for recovery rights. And I don't think we're ever going to reach agreement on this point. The second area of disagreement is the subject of our current discussions and relates largely to communication. Most archivists will argue that the easiest way for a seller to determine if they have a government document and if the government wants it back is to contact the appropriate state or local archives and ask. Many sellers are extremely reluctant to do so because this could hasten or perhaps result in a replevin action. We've been looking at anonymous contacts and other steps as options. Revealing buyers' and sellers' names is another related area where archivists and many dealers disagree. And on some of these points, we're nearing agreement, and some of them we aren't. I think our closest agreement is over the issue of due diligence and investigating provenance, and we still have quite a ways to go on some of these communication questions. But the steps we've moved forward with have been quite positive at this point. Just to conclude my remarks, I don't think disputes and issues related to government documents will ever completely disagree or disappear. And of course, that's good for the legal community. Both sides will keep lawyers busy and employed. I should emphasize that the situation here will always vary quite a bit from state to state, both based on the state laws and just simply the inclination of certain states or entities within a state to be much more aggressive in trying to recover documents. But these steps that improve due diligence and improve communication are good goals, and I'm anticipating that some useful procedures will be developed by the Council of State Archivists and the Manuscript Society. Now turning to our speakers, we have three panelists, and I'll introduce all three of them now. And then we'll follow up their remarks with an opportunity for discussion and questions. Our first speaker will be Menzie Berend-Kloot. Menzie is from Madison, Wisconsin. She works as an archivist, attorney, and consultant with Kloot and Associates. Her legal experience with intellectual property, the licensing and contracts is quite extensive. Much of her work has been with museum and corporate archives. You may note that SAA has published two books in which Menzie shares her expertise. Navigating Legal Issues in Archives was published in 2008, and in 2005 she co-edited with Peter Walsh Privacy and Confidentiality Perspectives, Archivists and Archival Records. Menzie will be followed by Karen Blum, sitting in the middle up here. Karen is an Assistant Attorney General with the North Carolina Department of Justice and represents the Department of Cultural Resources. Two of her clients are down there in the second row, keeping a careful eye on her. Or are you keeping an eye on them? In this capacity, she has worked on the recovery of alienated public records, including the state's copy of the Bill of Rights, several 1861 documents related to the beginning of the Civil War, and even a captured and later stolen Confederate battle flag. Karen has a bachelor's degree in Japanese studies from the University of North Carolina and a master's degree also in Asian studies. Before earning her law degree and joining the Attorney General's office, she worked for 5 years in a Japanese plastic injection molding factory. Well, that sounds fascinating. I'm guessing when she tells me she loves her job, she's talking about the current one and not her career in plastics. I think the only other person I've heard of with a career in plastics was, what, Dustin Hoffman? We'll start with Menzie.
We'll see if this is, yes, it's on. I'm going to give a brief background today about Replevin, what it is, and talk about some of the older cases that involve historical records, and then turn it over to folks who probably have information that, who will have information you can probably use. I think it's helpful just to understand what the legal parts of the action are, and then how you'll hear how they've been used successfully in other cases. First, some definitions. Replevin is a legal remedy that provides a means to recover missing and wrongfully taken personal property from anyone who has taken it or who holds it unlawfully. In our case, archivists who are going to try to recover missing records. Just by way of contrast, replevin is not a tool that can be used to recover real estate or something like missing cash. It's personal property that this applies to. So public and governmental archivists can and do use replevin, as do museum curators, to try to secure the return of missing valuable historical documents and objects. Occasionally, too, a governmental agency has used replevin for the return of records housed in a historical society or other public repository or just from its own files. So in order to be recoverable and recovered by replevin, the personal property has to be tangible, something that you can see and feel, identifiable, that's a key, and something separable so that it may be seized and returned. I'm going to shift this a little bit. Whoever seeks the return of missing property through replevin must be able to prove ownership of it, and that sometimes is an issue. It's a key element to success. Sometimes, as David has alluded to, proving continuous ownership can be a barrier for the original, the first, the earliest owner. Title is something that may have to be proved as well, if the concept of title is applicable, particularly to a thing, a museum object or something like that, but also to records in some cases. In some of the more recent cases, as we'll hear, proving that the ownership of the item can be difficult, and the inability to fulfill this requirement can make it difficult to have standing, to have the right to try to recover the missing item or to bring the replevin action. So while replevin is used most frequently by individuals who want to recover personal property, as David also alluded to, the fact that we have valuable items in our collections, the increased awareness of that value, and the fact that there's a ready market through online sales and online auction sites also encourages both the disappearance of historical or valuable records and also their reappearance for sale. So replevin, just again as background, is an ancient common law remedy. Many states have since incorporated aspects of the common law into their state law processes, and we'll hear more about the different laws today. The requirements of replevin do differ from state to state, but overall there are some similarities. As I mentioned, the key elements are things that you have to be aware of and be able to prove. Whatever the process is, it generally must be followed fairly carefully and precisely in order to succeed. You have to prove what you have to prove at some point. A replevin action is initiated by a plaintiff who is the legal owner of the missing property against a defendant who currently has possession of the property. This is when it gets to the stage of something you would take into court. I think Karen is going to talk about other ways of trying to recover property without actually being in court. But if you have to go to court to recover your property, the plaintiff will begin the action either by filing a complaint in the court or by seeking the issuance of a writ of replevin prior to obtaining a judgment demanding the return of the property. The court may order the seizure of the property before or after a hearing, depends on the state law and the state requirements. The plaintiff also may be required to pay a bond, to post a bond to reimburse the defendant if there are any losses that the defendant sustains if the plaintiff can't prove the case, can't prove ownership. To succeed, once you get to court, the plaintiff also must have some sort of written proof, again, that the plaintiff is the owner of the property or lawfully entitled to possess it, that the property is wrongfully held by the defendant, and that the property was not lawfully taken for some lawful purpose, for taxes, assessments, fines, something like that, or because of a judgment against the plaintiff. So, again, the concepts all revolve around ownership and the right to claim that the plaintiff owns the property. There often is some approximate value of the property that has to be shown as well. Depending on the legal process of the state and the requirements, the disputed property then may be seized and delivered to the plaintiff by the sheriff or the U.S. Marshal or the other officer, depending on the state, municipality, county, again, before or after a court hearing. It varies from state to state. Eventually, though, the court will hold a hearing on the complaint. The defendant can present evidence to dispute the claim or to defend that the taking of the property was lawful, and then the court determines who is entitled to keep the property. And that's, of course, you know, I've gone from one sentence to the other real quickly, but that's the meat of the case. You have to be able to prove your case and defend against anything that the defendant may say. Whoever wins the case will either keep the property if they already have it or be required to return it or transfer it to the rightful owner. Considering the long history of replevin as a legal process, there are relatively few cases that have been reported involving public or historical records, and we'll hear about the recent ones in a few minutes. Most of the action replevin actions today involve tangible personal property, such as when museums try to recover missing objects of great value to the museum. But some of the older cases of interest to archivists are those that I'll give you a little background on right now. Replevin of public records, government records, usually involves the types of things, the records that belong to various governmental units. The creator owned them under ownership rights established in the law or by a local ordinance. When public records disappear and are known to be elsewhere, the public archives may employ replevin to recover the records of the public's business and to ensure the integrity of the public record. While establishing ownership of public records may seem to be easy, as we've said and as David had alluded to as well, when records disappeared years or decades previously, both the passage of time and conflicting claims to materials that now may have great value may make the process of proving ownership difficult, especially without things like ownership stamps, stamps on the record saying this is owned by this institution, especially if there are no listings and inventories or catalogs that have been compiled over the years identifying this document owned by this institution, or if there is no other proof of that ownership and sometimes that chain of ownership, that continuous ownership over the years. One such dispute about whether a document was a public record involved a letter written by George Washington to officials of the city of New York in 1785. Nearly 80 years later, a book collector named John Allen died, and when his library later was sold to a man named DeWitt Lent for just over $2,000, the library included the Washington letter. The city of New York sued Lent, the buyer of the library, to recover the letter. In adjudicating the case, the Supreme Court of New York focused on the city's claims of ownership, which included distinctive features such as the letter's style, its address, and the content concerning legislation, which provided public notice, according to the court, that the letter was the property of the city of New York. Unlike other personal property, the terms and address of the Washington letter provided the original book collector with what they referred to as constantly recurring notice of its ownership by the city of New York, so that the collector's possession of the letter was wholly unexplained. There was no reason, according to the court, for this collector to have this document. The collector possessed the letter but had no legal title to it, and the city was declared to be the rightful owner of it. Another case in 1958, many years later, you see there weren't a lot of cases reported for many, many years, illustrates the painstaking review that a court may make of the origins and the subsequent possession of historical records. This case was the United States of America versus the First Trust Company of St. Paul, Minnesota, and it concerned 67 documents written by William Clark of the Lewis and Clark Expedition. The letters described the expedition's winter encampment near the mouth of the Missouri River in 1803 to 1804 and its explorations in the 2 years following that. The documents were totally hidden from public view for 150 years. They surfaced and were found in 1952 in the attic of a home of a woman named Mrs. Sophia Foster. She had died, and the letters were found in a desk that she owned that had previously been owned by her father, General John Henry Hammond. Mrs. Foster's daughter gave the papers to the Minnesota Historical Society, and then Mrs. Foster's executor of her will, which was the First Trust Company of St. Paul, then brought a legal action to settle the title to the papers between the Minnesota Historical Society and Mrs. Foster's heirs, who also claimed the document. So the executor's duty was to figure out who owned the letters and then to give the letters and the ownership and the title and the letters to the rightful heir or the rightful owner. Into this, the federal government intervened, saying that the government had claimed title to the documents as being part of the work product of the Lewis and Clark expedition, or alternatively, that Mrs. Foster's father, General Hammond, had wrongfully taken them from an Indian agency office in Lawrence, Kansas, where Clark had once been connected. After a long and careful review of the creation of the records, their origins, the intentions of the writers, information about those who commissioned the expedition, and the custody and the ownership of the documents, the court was not persuaded by the federal government's claim. The court found that the president at the time, Thomas Jefferson, had given careful instructions to Meriwether Lewis, one of the leaders of the expedition, but did not require others in the party to keep an official record or a diary or notes. Lewis himself had referred to Captain Clark's private journal in a letter to Jefferson. The documents contained much data, such as what Jefferson had requested Lewis to gather in his official record, but they also included a great many personal and private notations, including information about the receipt of newspapers or letters, details of personal illnesses, social engagements, and other items as might not be expected to be found in notes of an official character or in an official record. So in other words, Clark's notes were not an official government record. They were not public records. And in this case, because General Hammond and his heirs possessed the general's original writings, his own personal writings, there was a presumption, the court found, that the family owned all of the letters, including the Clark letters, which then transferred the burden of proof to the federal government to establish its title to the papers. So again, ownership, title, key concepts needing to be proven. And in this case, the government did not succeed. The 67 documents were private and personal writings of Clark, made for him for his personal use. They were not an official work product of the Lewis and Clark expedition, and nor had the government been able to prove its claim that these were records held by the Indian agency that somehow Clark had left there and the general had gotten. So the family, the Foster and Hammond family, did not succeed in its claim. The documents eventually wound up at the Yale University Library. The federal government did not get them. The family did get them. The government did not get them. The family got them. The Minnesota Historical Society did not have them, and eventually they were transferred to the Yale University Library. Nearly 20 years later, or more than 20 years later, in 1976, a situation similar to the Clark situation presented itself in a case called the State of North Carolina versus West. But in this case, the State of North Carolina successfully identified and established its ownership of the disputed records, which I think is probably the first in a successful run of cases that we'll hear about shortly.
Second.
Okay. All right. In this case, the records were two bills of indictment issued in 1767 and 1768, signed by William Hooper, an attorney for the King of England, and someone who was later a signer of the Declaration of Independence. The defendant, West, was an autograph dealer who purchased the documents in good faith through a New York auction house and the claim was that they had been purchased from a North Carolina, excuse me, from a North Carolina resident and a museum. The North Carolina Division of Archives and History provided the history of the indictments, provided information about the history of the indictments, including several transfers of other old court records and copies of pages from its 1767-1768 court docket. The archive's testimony was that it held similar records, some of which were now missing, that it did not know when or by whom they were removed until these two particular documents appeared for sale in 1974 or 75. The state was not able to show that these exact two documents were missing, nor when or how they may have been removed, but all of its evidence suggested that the state owned and held title to the two disputed documents, and they were able to demand possession of them based on the strength of that evidence. In this case, the initial action was held in the trial court, and then it was appealed, so there was an appellate court. In the lower court, the trial court, found no evidence about how long the documents had been held by the government, nor where they had been for 200 years. They did not find any evidence about when or how they'd been removed from the archives, and so they awarded them to West, the person who had bought them most recently. The state of North Carolina then appealed this decision, and basically they won a reversal. They won the right to the documents back. The appeals court focused solely on the legal question of ownership of the records and found that the state had proved that the indictments were required by law to be permanently retained, and that the state had proved that the indictments had been in a public archive and were stolen or improperly removed, and therefore they awarded them to the North Carolina archives. So that was a successful outcome. And I'm just going to mention, to finish up, a few of the state laws that focus solely on replevin of public records. Maine's Protection and Recovery of Public Records statute authorizes the Maine State Archivist to initiate action whenever there are reasonable grounds to believe that state or local government records are in the possession of someone not authorized by the state archivist or another lawful custodian to have those records. There is a Delaware public records law that allows the Delaware Attorney General, at the request of the state archivist and records administrator, to recover and replevin any public records that have been unlawfully transferred or removed and to seek their return. And Texas law also permits the state to demand the return of archival records in private hands if they were improperly removed from state control. And then it allows the state, if the records are not returned, it allows the state to seek a court order to compel the return of the records. So just to finish up, a couple of questions, some useful questions that an archivist should consider in trying to decide whether the issues suggest a replevin action or whether perhaps the archives may be faced by replevin action from a government agency seeking the return of records to the government agency that are held by the archives. One question is, should every effort be made to recover documents that were removed from the archives illegally? Are the original documents sufficiently significant and valuable to warrant legal action? Would having a copy of the documents suffice rather than the return of the original? You may want to weigh the publicity value of a successful replevin action. It may deter thieves and others who would like to consider taking records from the archives. Or it might be an embarrassing disclosure of security problems. Or even in today's climate, it might be viewed as an overbearing attempt by big government to harm a citizen. Also weigh the likely costs of the reply and action should it wind up in court. As I've mentioned, you will need to be able to prove the necessary elements to be able to succeed with a replevin action: ownership, chain of custody, title if needed. Someone, maybe you, may need to testify in court about this. Get your proofs of ownership in line. As I said, stamps or markings, detailed accession records or inventories, listings and guides and indexes, all the things that we're used to, but it's going to be helpful if you need to prove them. Records of researcher, use of documents, who's had their hands on them over the years, photographs, appraisals, if the documents are valuable, if you have listed them on an insurance policy, if they're that valuable, that would be helpful as well. Again, as I mentioned, if theft is the issue, gather your proof that any suspect had access to the missing records. If you have any of that kind of correspondence, logs, research records, researcher records. And finally, as David mentioned, if the archives is the subject of a replevin action by another repository, or in any case, do some investigation yourself about the acquisition of the disputed document and its current holder. Are any transactions suspicious? Do the documents properly belong elsewhere? And finally, what is the archive's best interest in the matter? So all of these considerations will help if you have to pursue a replevin action or if you're the subject of a replevin action. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and pass the baton to Karen.
Thank you, Menzie. Checking to see who's around the corner over there. I know there's a.
It's
kind of hard to see everybody.
As
David and Menzie mentioned, North Carolina has had great success over the last 30, 40 years in recovering alienated public records, whether they were alienated by theft or mysterious disappearance. We've probably covered all of that. And I think the most helpful thing for me to do is to go through some of the mechanisms that North Carolina has used and is currently using to recover alienated public records. And I'll just mention, David had mentioned the recovery of the Confederate flag. North Carolina's Public Record Act has two means of recovering public records. One is criminal and one is civil. In the definition of public records, artifacts are included. And so you may be thinking, how did this flag get in this public records action? That's because North Carolina has a definition that includes artifacts as public records. Over the last, and I'm going to focus mostly on the last 7 years, and the documents that have been, or the public records that have been recovered, based largely on State v. West, which Menzie just went over. Before I do that, I shamefully forgot that I should insert the disclaimer that these are my opinions, not necessarily the opinions of the North Carolina Attorney General. I've got to stick that in there, and I sort of forgot to do that at the beginning. Recently, North Carolina has used four mechanisms. The first is the least severe, just issuing a demand letter to whoever we think has the record, and North Carolina has done that twice and been successful, and I'm going to go into and break these down by public record. North Carolina also uses the Public Records Act and files petitions for return of public record, and that's built right into the Public Records Act. That's the civil remedy. You can have a criminal remedy, too, where you go demand that somebody turn something over, and if they don't, it's a misdemeanor for each public record. I'm speaking only about the petition for return of public record, the civil remedy, and the two aspects of that are either getting an injunction to enjoin sale or destruction or movement of the record or seizure. Ex parte seizure, which pretty much means that the state can go to a court and get a court order for seizure without even telling you that it's doing that, and that is to prevent the document or the public record from going underground as soon as somebody figures out that North Carolina wants to try to recover the public record. We've also used civil forfeiture, federal laws in the Bill of Rights case, and that's based on the interstate transportation of stolen goods. And also in the Bill of Rights case, a declaratory judgment where you file an action in the court and in a state court and you ask the state to apply state property law and declare who the owner of the public record is or what the rights are of the parties to that public record. Now, I'll go back to the beginning with the demand letters. We've done demand letters in a couple of different ways. One is by having the custodian of the public record send a letter to whoever has the record saying, can y'all hear me in the back? Okay. A demand letter saying, this is the property of the state of North Carolina. Any factual basis that we've come up with. Any information that's been provided, particularly by auction houses, about the record, for example, quote the docketing on the back, you know, where the clerk or somebody has written Senate Journal and a date that they clearly marks it, as in the West case, you know, as a court record or a legislative record of the state. One of the instances that we used recently was an April 1777 House resolution nominating the first government council of state and governor of the state. And this was found on an auction house in Dallas, Texas, and we got a citizen tip. Somebody called in and said, I think this is yours. The custodian, Dr. Jeffrey Crow, issued a demand letter saying this belongs to the state. And the auction house, of course, immediately said, no, it doesn't. It belongs to the person, you know, except then it arrives in FedEx a couple of weeks later. You know, oops, thank you very much. Here's your record back. So that's one demand letter. The other demand letter would come from the Attorney General's office, and you kind of have to balance out which way you're going, and there are pluses and minuses to having your attorney send the letter. One of the minuses is some people lawyer up as soon as they see a letter from an attorney. They dig their heels in. They may do that. But other people may just get scared and say, oops, here you go. And we had a public record come up in 1861 public record come up. It was a draft resolution to the governor asking him to call for a convention of the state to consider secession. That was in an auction house in Beverly Hills, California, and a person from the National Coalition for History called in and said, I think you may want to come look at this record. And we looked at it, and the Attorney General's office issued a letter very similar to the other letter saying, please give this back. It's the property of the state of North Carolina. It's a public record. Neither the legislature nor the North Carolina Historical Commission has ever authorized it to leave the custody of the state. And fortunately, in that case, we got the same response. No, this belongs to my client. You can't have it back, but we'll settle with you, and we'll give you the document back if you acknowledge it as a donation and agree to fill out the federal IRS tax form. And again, the state doesn't have to do anything with that tax form other than to say we received this document. So those are two different takes on issuing a demand letter, one from the custodian of records and the other from either the state's attorney, the county attorney, whoever your attorneys are. The second mechanism is a petition for return of public record, which is a North Carolina law. And I realize that other states may not have a law like this, but it may just get you thinking about other ways that you could pursue your public records. We've used the injunction method before where the auctioneer was a known factor, somebody the archives had dealt with, didn't think this was the Confederate flag, was not going to go underground. This was in 2005. Got a court to issue an injunction to prevent the sale, but the artifacts stayed up on the auction site, and it appeared that they were continuing to try to sell it over the weekend. And so by Monday, we had a sheriff go and seize the flag. And one of the misconceptions is that when you come seize it, you're just going to keep it. And that's not what happens. When you seize it, it goes into the custody of the court. And what we did is we got a safekeeping order because the State Archives or the Museum of History is used to storing and preserving valuable artifacts. Under court order, this flag was in the custody of the court in like a little fictitious bubble in the Museum of History where it could be properly maintained in the right climate and locked up and secured. So that was another mechanism that we used. Also, with the petition for return of public record, can just outright have a seizure of the record. And in 2004, we did this for Jefferson Davis letter, and a 1961 Jefferson Davis letter that ended up in an auction house in Graham, North Carolina. And somebody in the State Archives was kind of flipping through a catalog and said, "Ooh, that looks like one of our records." And after we looked into it, it appeared to be so. I think I mixed these up. One was the Confederate flag. We did have this seized. I should go back to the flag. The flag we did not have seized. We just got an injunction because we knew the person wasn't going to run away with the flag, knew the person was just, you know, loved the flag, wasn't going to destroy it, wasn't going to go overseas, wasn't going to flee with it, wasn't going to sell it. The Jefferson Davis letter was the one that stayed up on the auction site, and we did have that seized and ended up settling it. You know, just because you start litigation doesn't mean that you can't continue to sit down at the table and talk to the person on the other side. What it does is give you some protection by court order that the artifact is not going to run away and be sold, because a lot of times what happens is the state or, you know, the repository doesn't find out until the day of the auction, the day before the auction, a couple days before. I mean, how do you put the brakes on? And one of the ways we've done it is through either a seizure or an injunction. And I realize the states are going to differ. I'm just trying to throw some ideas out there. Civil forfeiture, as I mentioned before, is another mechanism. This is a federal law. For example, if you use a car in the interstate transportation of, you know, stolen goods, you're fencing some stolen items, or you have a car that's packed full of drugs and it gets seized, well, the government's gonna sell that car off at auction unless some claimant comes forward and says, "Hey, wait a minute, that's mine." The Bill of Rights, and this is an original copy of the Bill of Rights to the United States Constitution that was sent to each state by George Washington in 1789 that had floated around and appeared in various locations since 1897, I think it is, probably stolen out of the State House in Raleigh during the Civil War, carried off by a Union troop. The FBI stepped in to help the state. U.S. Attorney's Office also stepped in to help. They set up an undercover operation and arranged a sale to the National Constitution Center in 2003, and the attorney for an antiques dealer showed up there to sell the Bill of Rights to the National Constitution Center, which was going to open in 2003, supposed to open in the fall. They had approached the antiques dealer, had approached the Constitution Center and said, "Hey, I got a Bill of Rights. Wouldn't you like to have that for your opening later in the year?" "Yeah, it's probably worth $30 million, but we'll give you the bargain basement, $5 million, you know, sale." And of course, when you go to New York, you buy a Rolex for $5, you know, it's either fake or it's stolen. And so that's what happened in 2003 under civil forfeiture laws of the state. Got involved by saying it was one of the claimants and ended up fighting with an antiques dealer and his purported business partner. And when that action voluntarily went away before any of the litigation was settled, the state also pursued the last action, and I wanted to mention a declaratory judgment action in state court this time, saying we want to get this back, court, help determine the rights of the parties. And so through this declaratory judgment action in 2008, we're finally able to regain both possession and ownership of the Bill of Rights. That is pretty much it for me. I'm sure we'll have some questions, and I'm going to turn it over to David.
We'll now open it up for questions. I'll moderate or mediate as necessary. Yes.
I'm Joe Clapp from the New Jersey State Archives.
Why
does the future have a right to anything considered?
Right.
Okay, we have a question about the keeping of public records in private repositories. Mm-hmm. That was a very brief summary.
Yeah, I think I heard the word travesty too, but let's try to calm down a little bit about what we're talking about here. It seems to me that every repository, manuscript collection, especially those that have been around for a very long time, took on the responsibilities that now are trying to be, I think, revisited in a kind of deconstruction approach. I think that there is no travesty. We acted in an ethical manner to acquire those materials at that time. They were offered to us by deposit, transfer, or purchase. We made those materials accessible to the public. They have been cataloged and cared for, and we've done our responsibilities as archivists. Certainly, any material now, though, since the 80s that comes available to us, we automatically question whether or not it's a public record. And I think that reflects the changes in attitudes in our understanding about these materials. And I don't speak, I think, alone. I think we're all doing that, especially as we become more sensitive to the issues. However, I can tell you, though, that if you came knocking at my door tomorrow and wanted the 100,000 public records that you identified, that's just not going to happen without a very lengthy court battle. And I, you know, I just think that we're all in that situation, frankly.
Yes.
If I understand, though, you're affiliated though with a state entity, the University of California, Berkeley. So you're really not a private collection or private library. You're an arm of the state. So I think that shades us a little differently, and perhaps in your favor. Where is the State Archives of California placed? What agency?
Secretary of State.
Perhaps there needs to be some kind of discussion in California at what state agency handles public records, or can they be split?
Mm-hmm.
But still, I mean, you're not a private collection of manuscripts or a board.
Yeah.
And also, I'm kind of surprised that in international law that statute of limitations can run against the sovereign government. I'm just surprised to hear that.
Now the comment was, for the tape's purpose, that the University of California is also a state entity. And I think I would just add my comment that most state archives are less likely to pursue recovery of documents that are in any public entity, especially if that entity is making the documents accessible in their state, that just the logistics and practicality and cost mitigate against that. And I guess Nancy might say something. The California law also, what, provides a safe haven?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're safe.
I never thought we were in danger.
I should also add that recently we were offered county records for sale, and I think this reflects a problem that our state and probably others are experiencing financially. Many of the counties are struggling to find ways of reducing their costs, and one of them is to get rid of their records. And I don't know how extensive it is, and I don't know if any of you have had that experience so far, but it seems certainly in California where we're struggling financially, one of the first things that they think about doing is getting rid of their, you know, storage requirements and throwing their records away. And I think this dealer had actually found them in a dumpster, extensive records that that he just pulled out of a dumpster. And I don't know what the issue would be, the state archives would take those or not, but certainly that's a problem.
We've reached the end of our time period, but we'll take just one more question, and then the panelists will be available to talk with everyone afterwards.
Ms. Bunt from North Carolina, mentioned in passing that there are a number of ways that you've settled, but not everything goes to court that you've settled. Could you explain to us some of the kinds of settlements that you've reached with people who have self-determination?
Sure. The question is, in North Carolina's case, in the cases that I mentioned in recovering documents, I mentioned that North Carolina has settled in some of the cases, and in those cases, what was involved in the settlements. I should point out up front that North Carolina, unlike some other states, since at least the late 1800s, has refused to purchase stolen public records or alienated public records. So when we talk about settlement in North Carolina's case, of course, that's not one of the options. Now, other states might want to consider that. Other repositories may feel that because of their state laws, that is the only possible, you know, avenue to ensure recovery of the documents of the public records. In North Carolina's case, with the Jefferson Davis letter, the settlement just involved, an acknowledgement of donation and a joint press release. And I think the possessor or owner of the document, the one who was trying to auction it, wanted to be very careful about his identity getting out there, and so we did the joint press release. In the Bill of Rights case, during the civil forfeiture action, the antiques dealer conveyed any interest that he had or thought he had to the state, and that was in the civil forfeiture action. In the declaratory judgment action, which was the state court action, the settlement was with the purported business partner, and this was before the summary judgment ruling by the court. And he pretty much did the same thing that I mentioned before about asking the state to fill out the IRS form 8283, whatever that charitable contribution form is, and allowing a neutral appraiser to come in to the archives at a set time to appraise the document for purposes of his filling that out. But we made sure we put at the bottom, something to the effect that there was no acknowledgement of who owned what, just merely that North Carolina was accepting the document.
Let's thank our panelists, and thank you for attending.